Hi everyone, welcome to ADHD Brief. I'm Kaylee Smith, a registered psychotherapist in Ontario and your host. This isn't your typical therapy podcast. Here, I ditch the clipboard and sit down with friends, family, and people with lived experience to have informal, unfiltered conversations about ADHD, mental health, and what it's actually like to live with a neurodivergent brain. As a therapist, I love having these conversations, but this podcast isn't therapy and it isn't intended to provide personal clinical advice. It's real talk, personal stories, and don't worry, we still try to keep it funny. Whether you've been diagnosed, you're exploring your brain, or you're just ADHD curious, welcome. Brains don't always play by the rules. Let's talk about it.
Okay, welcome to this week's episode of ADHD Brief. Today I have a special guest here, my brother, Griffin. And today we are going to have an important conversation and also a pretty personal one where we talk about ADHD and addiction and how these two things can intersect and hear Griffin's personal story with addiction, recovery, his journey with ADHD. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming on. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Super exciting. Perhaps you've heard most of it.
I may be knowledgeable of this story on a personal level, but I think piecing it all together for people to hear is a really important thing to do, because I think a lot of people will probably relate to parts of your story, all of your story. And
yeah, it's the whole point of sharing. As long as it reaches out to one person, really, that's the goal. That's the human empathy for sure.
Absolutely.
That's all it's about.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's start from the beginning. So tell me a little bit about what your life was like before getting diagnosed with ADHD. Mm. Like, kind of take me back to the beginning of early years.
Yeah, so it was only recent, 35 now. It was about four months ago there with an actual diagnosis from a doctor. Mm-hmm. Of it.
So he's very recent into his ADHD journey.
Yeah. So, and maybe before that, I think a lot of the culture was, it was a superpower, as most people call it. ADHD is just a superpower, right? Because a lot of, I just think the general public, maybe not the general public, but I guess we can call them like normies, so to say, like look at it as a superpower, like on the good side of it, because wow, like we can multitask really well. Wow, they're so good in a crisis situation. Wow, mm-hmm. They're so good at this. So for me, I always thought of it as that, because there are those times of like, wow, like I am nailing it today, mm-hmm. right? And we can, which in a sense is that superpower, but I don't think a lot of sort of the normies understand the neurodivergent, the darker side of it, right?
The disability aspect of it.
Yeah. And that is the, you know, we always, I mean, it's a slight like joke, I want to say about it, right? Where it's just that, they're just awesome. They're just hyperactive. They're just this. So like I learned in those 35 years how to manage it the best way, because that's the only way I knew how it worked, right? Mm-hmm. And that...
So those were your kind of underlying beliefs about ADHD, is that yeah. was that hyperactivity that you could kind of like take that energy and put that into things at like a really high functioning level.
Yeah. And in a sense that we really are, right? We're good leaders. We're good. A lot of like even entrepreneurs, yeah. we all share this commonality because of that. So
quite,
it is
quite creative.
Yeah. And it is a sense of like, of that, yeah, it is just my superpower. It is just who I am. And we all joke like, haha, squirrel, right? Like, mm-hmm. but that's not what it is. So in a sense of like, but in those like 35 years of like, this is now how my brain has been programmed, is to react to all these things too. So it's an interesting journey now to see like, oh, like that, my brain was just really just programmed to look for anything that made me feel good. At all times.
So
right?
That's what you really notice, is mm-hmm. that like dopamine seeking interest based nervous yeah. system.
And then if you times that by, you know, however older you get, right, in that experience, it just tenfold, so to say, right? Yeah. And that you don't even realize it, that natural, I didn't want to I didn't want to deal with anything bad, confrontation, anything that was going to be a negative thing. I would avoid. But as you get older, you just even naturally do that without consciously thinking that I don't want to avoid that too. So in a sense, with that ADHD superpowers, we look extremely lazy and then we also look extremely productive, right? And it's...
depending on what you're interested in.
Yeah. And I think that's the darker side of it. To almost see like, it's almost just reprogramming the brain, but to some degree for sure. Yeah. And
relearning what's actually happening and checking in on your own internalized ableism, like your own beliefs about what ADHD is or what it isn't, and kind of sifting through all of the stigma around it to go, okay, what is actually happening? What's the invisible disability portion of what my brain is going through, what my nervous system is going through, based on what I think this label means.
Yeah, and that's it too. So we've almost like changed the culture of like, it was a, you know, a fun thing to be like, oh, little Billy's just hyper, he's got the ADD, to like, now everybody has it, right? And it's like, we've all self-diagnosed each other, right? It's like, I think we've, it's good to see that. So like, say like the stigma is gone, but it feels like too many people are joining the tribe that really don't maybe need to find, not that it's good or bad, but like it's kind of gone the opposite way, so to say. So because I get very aggravated with, you know, the self-diagnosed people and the, you know, I got this. But at the end of the day, humans are just tribal. So we just kind of want to fit into wherever. But
I think that's even something that we talk about in our like ADHD circles around. I think it can also be a bit of a misconception that everybody has ADHD now, or everybody is diagnosing themselves, when in reality, it's actually still a fairly small percentage of people who are actually getting treated for ADHD. I think a lot of people that are now going as adults later in life, wait, is this a thing? It's because they just weren't diagnosed as kids. And in reality, they do actually meet the criteria. And I think a lot of them are women.
Yeah. And having different women in my life and seeing how different, maybe the symptoms, I don't know if that's the right word, come out.
Yep.
Drastically different, right? Yep. And it's interesting to see. But I mean, I always ask the question of like, are there any normal people in this world? Or did obviously, I'm going to attract other neurodivergent people because, surprise, we get along.
Can't imagine why.
Just looking back on it, I'm like, huh, so maybe that's why I just haven't met anybody. Because, like, we just don't, we naturally just attract those people, right? And it's a, but, I mean, as they say, normal is just a setting on the dryer. So,
I don't know if I've ever heard that
one. It's a classic.
No, that's so good. Normal is just a setting on the dryer. Yes.
You could have that one.
Thanks.
It's all yours. Maybe that's the truth of it, right? Is that like even seeing people with like young kids that are also neurodivergent too, and then they're diagnosing their children at the same day. It's like, well, maybe they're just two, right? Like maybe, but no, and then you see those things come out in a toddler and you're like,
yeah. Well, cause there's a genetic link too. Like I think a lot of people, I mean, if they're already diagnosed and then they have biological children, they go, well, this could be a thing. Yeah. Or it's the reverse. Their child gets diagnosed and then all of a sudden parents are like, hang on a second. I didn't think that was abnormal because I did that.
Right.
Or that's me. Like, that's not ADHD. And then the wheels start turning and you go, oh.
So hopefully we can change that culture with those who choose to have children, the millennials that get diagnosed later in life that have those children. Hopefully then they can learn and have the proper care for the kid too. Because, I mean, it's not that I... on a personal note of like, I regret not getting the diagnosis as a child, like, oh, poor me, what could have been for 35 years? But it's like, no, maybe let's do better. Just cause if that kid can get that early diagnosis when their brain is developing, obviously developing to the frontal cortex, like that could be huge to give that kid a chance, wouldn't it be therapy or medication or occupational therapy or whatever it may be. So hopefully, I mean, that's what we should do for the next generation, but hopefully that should be the narrative.
So you in your own like early stages of diagnosis, because I also talk about this with people that post-diagnosis, there's can be sort of this like journey of re-understanding who you are, all of the things that went wrong in your life before you were diagnosed, and there can be grief, there can be a lot of loss around that, but for you, you feel like you're kind of like, I just want to move forward.
Well, yeah, again, with the with my like my addiction and recovery career, a lot of that like forgiveness to myself had already been done prior to those that past. We'll call it a I call it a career.
Yeah, I heard you use that word. I was like, well, let's dive into addiction career for a second.
What can we can stay? But like so, like that part of like the grief or the what if? Like no, I can truly not like that has been left in the past because the whole idea of recovery is like what is new, what can be. Mm-hmm. Finding the solution, so okay. to say, right? Because my solution prior to that was just drugs and alcohol. Okay. That was always my solution. So, okay. to when the doctor kind of like mentioned that too, and it didn't even cross my mind. It's not. I can't live in the past. That's mm-hmm. that's depression.
Like your new doctor when she yeah. when she diagnosed you and treated yeah. you, she mentioned that.
Okay. Yeah, and I can see that point to some people of like, oh my god, it could have been, but I don't have that thinking because it just again. Think in the past is just depression.
Right? Yeah, that's what it is for you.
And fear of the future is the anxiety. Okay. So like, it's not, it's new, but everything is new in recovery.
Yeah.
So to say.
That's I think that's a fair point to make because yeah. I think everybody's experiences with diagnosis are unique to them. And there doesn't have to be one right way to reconceptualize who you are, your past. And so for you, you're saying, and we're going to get into your addiction journey to kind of understand that more. You went to this place of, I have to kind of think of this as a fresh start. This is like the new version of me. And I don't go into the past because if I go into the past, that's where I get stuck. Yeah. Is that sort of fair to say?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's doing something different, mm-hmm. right? If I keep doing the same thing over again, and I expect the same results.
Well, what is that the definition of?
So like, you know, might as well try something new.
Yeah.
And, but, no, I mean, I was happy with the result and like, it's a personal journey, but at least I hope for those that can get the child, especially women at an early stage to whatever, at least not, you know, pump them full of meds if that's not your MO as a parent or whatever, but you know, understanding it and being able to develop it will hopefully help the next people.
You mean early stages yeah, of early recovery? Stages.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, no, I disagree with the early stages of recovery getting a diagnosis.
Oh, okay. We're gonna get into that. So tell me a little bit about like how you maybe self-medicated before getting diagnosed with ADHD. Like, tell me about your own addiction journey.
Yeah. I mean, they call it self-medicating. I called it using all day. It was, your body naturally, I mean, a lot of it was just your basic, weed and alcohol readily like available kind of all day, especially with cannabis was my big one.
Okay, so alcohol and cannabis.
Yeah, because they're readily available, and cannabis especially all day, I think definitely can kind of, it, you know, they takes the edge off, so mm-hmm. to say. But I think my edge was just more the insanity of the ADHD of the squirrels running in the head all day, mm-hmm. right? At least it can give me that
kind of. So your brain's going, yeah. going, and you want. Quiet,
right? And yeah. that's really what the cannabis would do, right? But again, it was.
How old were you at this point?
I first started like high school age on a regular. I dabbled in it a bit, depending on where I was living at that point, mm-hmm. what was readily available, mm-hmm. and it's a fine line of like, I mean, especially for like pre 18, 19 years old, like a kid. Right, is like there is a rite of passage for a kid to push those boundaries, smoke some dope, get drunk at a party. So it's a fine line, but I find myself as like in early teens where it was all day, every day, mm-hmm. right? And that
you went all in.
Yeah, and it was learning that like I don't even self-medicating, and tolerance levels is because now looking back on it was like, oh, I was looking for that dopamine hit all day long.
Yeah.
Right?
Dopamine hit, I mean, you're even describing that all or nothing brain style, like thinking style, if I'm doing something, I'm doing it at 100%.
Yeah.
There is no 20%, 30% moderation for a lot of ADHDers.
Yeah. And it was, so again, and, but those things were just, so it becomes a lifestyle, so to say, that it's always around, and it didn't ever feel like self-medicating. But when, like, I didn't have it, there was just instant depression, right? Mm. So it was always just something I leaned on. Mm-hmm. It was a clutch, right? Okay. Alcohol at night, go to sleep, right? And, mm-hmm. and I could smoke pot during the day, and I'm just a pothead, right? Mm-hmm. If, nothing wrong with that, mm-hmm. right? And again, once one leads into the other, and, you know, they say, if, you know, I believe cannabis is a gateway drug. It is, yeah. It is 100% that.
And yeah, cannabis is not the wonder drug we think it is.
No, and that was coming into recovery too. It was going into 12-step meetings and having an absent kind of lifestyle, and it was like, hey, but not even weed, like mm. right? And it was
it's kind of like underscored of like the yeah, severity of yeah, it. It's it, like, oh, okay, oh. There are harder substances you could be addicted to. Weed's just.
Yeah. And, but it was, you know, looking back at it, that it was like, oh, that was my whole life. I didn't know that, like, a genuine question of mine was like, how am I going to enjoy a movie? How am I going to enjoy camping?
Without weed.
Yeah. How am I going to have coffee in the morning? How am I going to drive? How am I going to do all these things? Yeah. Right. Because for those, my career, it was all day every day just with that. Yeah. And as if the other substances weren't around, well, at least Miss Mary Jane is still there for me. Yeah. Or at least like that kind of stuff. So that was one of the big things to get over. But looking back, it was like, oh, that was why, just looking for that all day, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what just made the brain quiet and made everything just a little bit more intense, mm-hmm. and a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But like anything you consume that makes it different, well,
yeah.
That was,
it's hard to stop consuming it.
Yeah, very hard. So it was always, that was kind of just the early career. Going into working for my carnival lifestyle and the people you meet and along the way, and those are the people that you attract in the world, and small town Ontario lifestyle, and you know that rite of passage as a kid, I was saying that it's such a difficult one to track, because you don't know what that career will turn into, right? Mm. But then again, for me, it was just always what was around, right? And getting into recovery, they always, counselors, whoever, ask you like, what's your DOC, what's your drug of choice? Mm-hmm. My thing was, well, what do you got? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care, right? I didn't have a specific thing. I would lean more towards the stimulants just mm-hmm. naturally. Surprise.
Red flag.
Right? And that was where, but it was whatever, what do you got?
Whatever was available.
Yeah, or wherever I was, right? Because again, the brain is just looking for
something.
For that dopamine hit. And unfortunately, it's an extreme amount of dopamine you get from the harder drugs. And
when did it turn from alcohol and cannabis to stronger?
Just doing it for the first time, first couple of times. And just like, I remember.
You were in your like, what, 20s?
Yeah. Well, a little earlier than that, 18.
Yeah.
First year going out to Winnipeg. It was straight after high school. So mm-hmm. yeah.
Griffin was in the carnival for those curious what the carnival career meant.
Yeah, it was what you, yeah, partied hard, work hard. Yeah. And but again too, that was why I loved it too, was because at that early age, feeling always less than, always feeling like the kid that was left out, like no matter what group of people I was in, I was always, I never felt I belonged. I always felt less than. Yes, I know I'm smart, but like I don't fit in with anything.
You don't apply yourself.
Yeah.
And I'm using quotations for anyone listening, because I hate that term.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you could do so well if you just applied yourself.
Every it's report like, card.
I know. And I just, every time I hear that, it's like, oh, just a dagger to my heart. I'm like, no, this is.
Yeah. So, I mean, even remember, like, I mean, for most of our, I didn't really like dabbling in weed occasionally when I was in high school, but not really until I was that 18, 19 years age. But yeah, I remember clearly doing, having some beers in the afternoon, and then the cocaine came out that night, and I had arrived.
You had arrived.
I said, right? Like I was, oh my God.
Okay.
Right? Like that.
Yep.
It, you know, they say like, well, the first hit's not going to get you addicted. Well, it was that, mm-hmm. oh my, I belong.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my, I can talk to people.
Yep.
Right. and not
and not get bored, not
and I was now we're off to the races, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, my addiction just wants more and more, and it just it'll always escalate, right? Because my addiction just wants me alone and wants me dead, right? Mm. That's all it wants. So it always, you always say to yourself, and I see a commonality of those addicts was, I swore I would never do that.
Mm-hmm.
I swore I would never put a needle in my arm, right? Mm-hmm. And I never did for that point, because again, I wasn't a drug addict, right? Right. It's because you always will trick yourself into that too. Mm-hmm. So one thing turns into that, and all of a sudden we're off to the harder drugs, because that's what's best, because I just mm-hmm. need more and more and more, and then it just,
because it's giving you more of a hit.
Yep. And
coke stops doing it, so you need to
mm-hmm.
up it.
Yeah. And yeah. It's the part of the addiction side of it is not just looking for the dopamine hit, but it's the obsession that mm-hmm. that I have, right? Is that obsessive nature is not just hyperfixating on something, but it goes beyond that, where that becomes my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Everything revolves around that, mm-hmm. right? And that's the difference between addicts and normal people.
Yeah.
Normal people's lives progress.
It's so interesting, because I remember once you elaborated, and it was just like so eloquent the way you said it, and it kind of got my wheels turning, where you talked about that obsession and how it's like this rumination that you can't get out of. And the way that you described it at that point, it sounded so much like OCD, where it's like this obsessive thought and then the compulsion, like mm-hmm. the compulsion to use, the compulsion, the all of the rituals even around using. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, as soon as you said that, I was like, I mean, ADHD, like neurodivergence, that's an umbrella. And you know, there's not only autism, ADHD, there's also trauma, all other things, but OCD and how those could potentially be interlinked.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, I do wonder how much of addiction could be potential OCD.
Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to tell my doctor as well, too, about that. It was that I see, like, coming into recovery where all those things dissipated, dissipated slowly over time, right? It was that... Yeah, that is what OCD is. It's not keeping everything in line. That's not.
Well, there's different subtypes of OCD.
Yeah, it's quite different. But it was, everything had to be perfect, right? It was never even.
Yeah, that's what I think I remember you saying. Like the things that you would line up before mm-hmm. using, and it had to be done in a certain like sequence and mm-hmm. order and.
Because you're looking for that perfect high. That's what you're chasing, right? Mm. So that perfect high that happened, whatever that day, that's what I have to lean up towards, right?
Right.
Because that's what I'm chasing every time. Yeah. And it never happens. Surprise.
Yeah.
So that's that was the big one, yeah.
Hmm.
For sure.
So how long did you struggle with addiction for? Like active addiction?
Started using when I... like heavier drugs, I want to say like 17, 18, 35 now. And I got sober. I've been almost sober for 9 years in August. So Woo! That was, I was 26 then.
Mm-hmm.
So really, yeah, those, that kind of 7 year stint,
mm-hmm.
Knowing, personal family and people in addiction, I was aware of that. But again, I'm just young. I mean, this is just a phase, right? And not realizing that how unmanageable my life truly was,
mm-hmm.
and that in that unmanageability and that chaos is kind of oddly what we like. Right?
Well, yeah,
I love it, right? Because again, the ADHD, we thrive in chaos.
Yeah,
and that makes my brain feel good, right?
And there's always a challenge. How can I get it?
Mm-hmm.
What's the, you know, how's the next way I'm going to try to get whatever it is that I'm looking for. It's new. It's exciting. There's a lot of like novelty and change, and it's just.
Yeah. Craziness.
Craziness.
It's insanity. Yeah. And I love it. Right. And that was more getting dope or getting drugs. It was that whole thrill of getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Not the actual, I got it.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. That's easy. But that whole
chasing the dopamine in the
yeah,
yeah,
you know, waiting for the guy for 40 minutes when he's supposed to be there in five and yell, like that whole thing is just, that was what would actually
mm-hmm.
was more the thrill of it than anything, right? So like actually, as an addict, getting a proper diagnosis and a prescription, you're like, oh, this is no fun. Like, oh, yeah, I guess I just get one next month. Yeah. It's just crazy, but so like from 18 to about, the 25, so like that's, say, seven years, mm-hmm. so to say. And that was, I wasn't a chronic relapser, as some are concerned, like going to different detoxes and rehabs. I mean, really, that was a couple detox stints, and then finally got it. But it was, one time thing, only been to like one treatment center, but that was for 2 years, including second stage. So like, to some, that's quite a long time. It wasn't a 30-day program. It was 2 years.
Yeah. I think the 30-day programs for people are not enough. And no. So I think the way that you did it, where it was like a much longer duration, I think is, in my opinion, what really impacted your ability to stay sober. Because after 30 days, I feel like you're still in the chaos. Like, that's a blip of time. And then where do you go from there?
It's, again, there's nothing, I mean, depending on the severity of it. But yeah, those 30-day programs are just, there's a business model.
I know.
And again, it's what you put into it at the end of the day and all that too. But it was finally surrendering, right? Mm-hmm. To just, right? I had to start actually listening to people around me, right? And And I mean, a big thing too was like going to, I went to treatment at the Salvation Army, which is a homeless shelter, and like arguably the worst.
Humbling experience,
right? And, but again, like it was what you put into it, and it was just how those life things happen, and it was just finally surrendering and mm-hmm. then using that fear of then going in further in recovery. I cannot be in that place again. Mm-hmm. I cannot. Mm-hmm. Right. And that, using that fear finally as an addict was finally a good,
yeah,
good
like
thing
that
to
almost
do.
Forced you to hit a rock bottom.
Yeah.
Like I use the term, you hit rock bottom when you stop digging.
Yeah, I hit bedrock at one point and then kept digging.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you dug for a while. But then eventually, once you stop digging and you go, this is something that I can't continue to do because I've lost everything.
Yeah, and it wasn't even like losing materialistic things. It was losing
although
people.
Although he had nothing.
I had two shoes and a sock, as I said.
Yeah.
One sock, that was it. You took me shopping because I didn't have any. Right. Like, I had nothing. I had a wallet with a health card.
Nothing.
Because I left my license at a bar to pay the tab.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I had, and that was, and even, even realizing then of, like, going to apply for welfare, social services. And I was like, I don't need that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do, Griffin. Mm-hmm. So just this very defiant alcoholic and addict at the start, as we most are. And then that finally, that surrender point too. But even coming out of the detox and going to there, I still use speed pills that night while I was there, right? All because some guy told me that's...
That detox?
At the treatment center, at the stabilization program.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Oh, these won't show up on a drug test. Didn't even think twice.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah. And then I wasn't like I had a euphoric high. He like took these speed pills. His mom had narcolepsy or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like awake all night. Like I had coffee, right? Mm-hmm. But I didn't have that euphoric, I'm high kind of feeling. And then just going outside and being like, oh, this could be my life. And that was the light bulb moment, mm-hmm. of like, oh.
Because if anyone is listening who lives in Ottawa or has been to Ottawa, who knows where the Salvation Army is downtown, that is, in my opinion, a humbling experience, because mm-hmm. I remember dropping you off there and I was in such terror I couldn't actually leave. I was supposed to drive home to Toronto that night, and I got a hotel room I think for 2 days because I was like, I can't leave him here. Like, he's not gonna come out of this place alive. But you did.
Yeah.
Stayed.
Yeah. Their success rate is 0.5% because of me.
Yeah.
That's what Rhoda told me. I'm saying. Like, that's a serious statistic, right? Like, that is the actual statistic, because that, like, core group of guys that I knew going there, I tell you, they're all dead.
I know.
And that's no joke, right? And you're like,
I remember going with you guys to those early recovery meetings, and we'll get into how the 12-step model played into recovery, but all of them are gone.
Yep. And that's the true fact of it too, right? And it's because again, like I said earlier, like my disease, it only wants me alone and dead. That's it, right? And that's the scarier part of it too. But by going there, and I mean that's just my own experience, but it was you know, doing group therapy sessions, and I could see the LCBO sign out the window. Like, I'm like, this is not,
yeah,
right? Like, but that is like, because life around you is not going to change for you.
Yeah.
That LCBO is not going anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. The people around you that are drinking or having fun is not going to change.
The people doing crack outside or whatever other drug, they're not going anywhere. Yeah, they can't.
Yeah, it's me that has to make the choice and react to that situation. You know? So every day when I go for breakfast next door and I'm getting offered this, that, and the other, and I'm like, nope. Gonna go eat my shitty pancakes. See you later. Mm-hmm. It's you know, I laugh about it, but
I think we have to laugh about it. Otherwise, you would just cry. Yeah. It's one or the other.
Pretty much.
And we like to use humor as a coping mechanism. So, it was something. What was I don't know how personal you want to get, but what was the kind of thing that made you go, I have to get sober? Was there any like specific incident, or was it just sort of everything is unmanageable?
The insanity or the obsession about it is like that all that doesn't matter, right? But what really got me was the lonely. It's not losing all the materialistic things; it's losing the people around you and realize the loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truer factor of it, right? Is that like looking back and seeing how those people pushed me out of their life, right? And that it was for the better, right? So I do say to a lot of like friends I know in the recovery, it's like, no, just stop talking to them. Let them go, because that's the only thing you can do.
It's so hard. And it's such a fine line to walk. And I remember, like, you know, going to therapists when you were in active addiction, and them saying, and as well as other people who've had loved ones struggle with addiction, and going, you can't enable it. You have to cut it off. You can't know where you live. You can't loan him money. You can't, when he calls, you can't answer the phone. Like, and it's like, just breaks your heart.
Yeah. And that, and I can see now with other friends of even like mothers, and that there's a different, there's love, right? It's a feeling. It's love. And love is different with everybody you know in your life. So it's very hard to not react to that natural way where you have to use that logical thinking, because again, and it is true where if you give me an inch, I'm gonna take a mile.
Yeah.
If you let me talk to you on the phone, all of a sudden I can text you. All of a sudden I can get in your room. All of a sudden I can get in your house. Right. And that
and
is,
then your
it's
stuff's
so hard.
Gone.
Yeah. And it's so hard to explain to other people, but that was truly what then saved my life, so to say, right. Where those people around me in my life. And it was that, oh, I don't have anything, right? And no one. And that was really the motivator behind it, right?
Yeah.
It was a bit, like I said, I can hit bedrock and keep digging, because like it doesn't matter, right? Like, even it's a lot of like sick thinking and living on the streets, and you can okay anything in your head. You're like, oh, this is my park bench. Oh, it's sunny today. All those, the insanity of it all. But no, it was not having people. Right. And that's the big one, is people closing their door, people shutting their blinds. And that's the big one that killed me for sure.
Yeah.
So thank you.
You're welcome. And I will say too, I didn't completely shut the door. It was,
no, but
the door would only be cracked open an inch with very firm boundaries.
If they're willing to help themselves, okay, I'm willing to go to the detox.
I'll take you to detox.
I will give you
I'll
drive.
I'll take you to rehab. Yeah. That's it. If you stay in rehab, I'll buy you cigarettes.
Yeah. So that's what you're supposed. You go to thing, I'll buy you candy, right? Your reward good behavior.
Yeah.
As bad as that sounds, it's true, because again, we're like toddlers at that point, right?
Know.
And that's where our brains are.
I'll buy you
are.
Cigarettes over crack any day. That's fine.
Yeah. So so that's how it should be treated, and it's too many. It's a very, I see it more with the mother relationship too, having friends and their mom. Like, mom will go,
I know,
to the end of the earth for you, right? Yeah. And that is the sort of the sadder part of it, right? But so it got me.
Okay.
Loneliness.
So you go into recovery. This is 12-step model based.
No, not the one I was at. My counselor was very 12-step,
okay,
old school, but the not the establishment, but the institution rather, mm-hmm. Is not many places now are 12 step. Okay. You can very, very rarely find it. A lot of them have stemmed away from it, gone to more of the smart recovery model.
Right.
Now AA in the rooms, because it's not a common, the culture has changed for good reasons, which we can get into later, but no, mine was not. My counselor was, luckily.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
because the 12-step model worked for you. And so for anybody that is listening, the 12-step is like that AA or CA or NA model.
Yeah, it's a Christian model with 12 principles and 12 steps. One is we admitted we were powerless and our lives became unmanageable. Mm-hmm. And there's a hyphen in that first step. So either subject is equally as important, right? Mm-hmm. My life is unmanageable. I'm also powerless, right? Mm-hmm. Once I have that first thing. And that first principle is honesty. Mm-hmm. And that's the big one for addicts, right? Honesty, mm-hmm. but in everything you do, right? Mm-hmm. And is with yourself, right?
Was that hard to switch? Because I know when you were in active addiction, from my point of view, we couldn't trust anything you said. No. I felt like you would lie about what you had for breakfast, what color the wall was.
Yeah, that's what I said.
What day of the week it was. Like, it was just, it became so second nature. So when you're switching and going, I have to be honest.
Yeah, and that's the biggest principle in the first step, right? And that is, that's it's being honest with yourself before you can be honest with others, too. It's just the sadder part of how manipulative I was. I would joke with people about, you know, grabbing their 2-6 out of the freezer and finishing it. So I'd be, tell them, it's because I'm an alcoholic. I would admit that even in active addiction just to get more,
mm-hmm.
right? Like I would, you know, joke about it in my head. So I always like kind of like knew.
Mm-hmm.
So admitting it, but like admitting that you're powerless, right? Once I have the first thing of anything that makes me feel good, we're done, mm-hmm. right? So actually realizing that like, oh, my brain is different, right? So that first step of honesty, it's the biggest and most important one.
And a really, really hard one to do.
Yeah, and then there's... to look it up.
It's okay. I won't make you go through all 12.
I used to know.
But
yeah, so it's a 12-step Christian model, and that's what it's based on. And but again, too, those steps were made by a guy pre or post World War II.
Yeah.
And so you had all these young guys come back from World War II that, again, what was the substance available then?
Mm-hmm.
Alcohol.
Yep.
Right?
And who are all trying to self-medicate and cope with trauma.
Yeah. So, like, again, the culture has changed, right? Yeah. So that AA model, though it worked for me, I never had a sponsor. I never actually did the 12 steps with a sponsor as they are suggested
to do, like them systematically where you
and again too, even they say, well, then that's a half measure, right? Half measures are never availed, right? Like you have to do it with a sponsor, right? But again too, my recovery is my own story, right? Like I tried with a couple sponsors, and again too was always a lot of the same stories of like, oh, they're arrogant, oh, they're this, and I'm like, I just I'm a lone ranger, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's hyper independence, right? That's what I've always had.
Trauma response.
That's what I know. So again, too, and it wasn't that. So I can. It's a tool in my tool belt.
Yeah.
Right. And again, too, I advocate for any. You know, I went to, so they tell you to do 90 meetings in 90 days, right? So I'm so defiant.
Which is, I'm sure.
I went to 110.
Perfect for your all or nothing brain.
So, you're like, so I went
90? I'll do 200.
I did 110 and I counted it and showed Rhoda, right? Right. But it was motivation to get out of the institution, go get on a bus, go do something that day and go meet people, right? Good people. Well, there's some bad apples, but there's good people.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's an important thing to highlight, because I think because the 12-step model, and I'm not advocating for or against that, because I think it does work for a lot of people. And for some people, it doesn't work because it can be very black or white, very rigid. You have to do it the right way and the systematic way and get the sponsor. But if you can take the good from it, leave the stuff that doesn't work for you and go, what can I get from this? And a big part of that is community.
Yeah, because again, like I said, my addiction wants me alone and dead,
yeah.
right? So if all of a sudden I'm not alone, right? And again, so those 90 meetings in 90 days, whatever, 110 I went to, 109 of them were shit to me, right? Because I didn't jive with the people. I'm in the basement of a church. It's musty, it's moldy. I feel like a sinner.
Yeah.
Like it's That's the truth of it.
They're always in basement
so
churches.
Again, the first home group I meet is in a office building above, and I'm like, oh my god, this is amazing, right?
Yeah.
And
we're moving on.
And it was, you know, again, it was like minded people, but those people, all my friends now, through that 12-step community, right? So the people that I knew in my career, well, geez, they were bad apples. Imagine that, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm going to aspire to be, right? So again, too, I have to change everything. So I give it up to just the community that it has. And there's truly some amazing people.
I agree.
But that again, too, is just planet Earth, right? But again, I needed that new group of faces, right? Yeah. And realizing that I am not alone. And that, you know, old Bill that's 90 years old is telling his war stories. I can laugh because he gets it.
Yeah.
Right?
No, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with that, because I do think that 12-step does get now in kind of our current life gets a bad rap because it can feel so extreme.
Mm-hmm.
But I think anybody that is curious about what it is, whether they are sober or not, or curious, I would actually encourage you to go to an open speaker meeting.
Yep, it's free.
They're free and just to understand the culture of it, because any meeting that I have ever walked into at any point, everyone has been so kind, so mm-hmm. welcoming. How are you? Get comfortable. In not asking personal questions. Oh, are you here for you? Or are you here as a supportive sibling? Like, there's no, you don't have to disclose personal information. Mm-hmm. You just sit. You're welcomed with open arms. Get a donut. Get your coffee if you want it. And then you get to listen to someone share their story so vulnerably. And it can be, in my opinion, a really positive experience.
Yeah, and going, like you said, to the open speaker one, so and I tell people that too, so they don't have to share, right?
Yeah, you just sit in the audience. You just listen,
right? And that is because again, with the looking at Hollywood's version of 12-step meetings, and it looks a little, you know, it's a little Hollywoodized.
Yeah, those are closed speaker meetings where you're doing actual step work where you have to share and talk, but an open speaker, anybody can go.
Yeah. And so, I mean, being in that community and doing, you know, getting a home group, doing the service work, going to detoxes, mm-hmm. jails, same thing. And I did that weekly. But again, too, you see some of the side of people that becomes their whole life
mm-hmm.
is an addiction. So just a newer mm-hmm. lifestyle. And yes, it's healthy, but it's like, all right, Janine.
But it's like a new hyper focus.
Yeah.
It's like a new special interest.
Totally. Right. Yeah. And their whole life is that. And I don't know. I struggle with it in my head of like whether I think that is, I mean, of course it has to be positive because, you know, you're not killing yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And you are helping people.
I mean, it's harm reduction. What would you rather, someone be obsessed with the addiction or the recovery?
Yeah. And the God concept, again, it's a Christian model, and the AA people, they will always say, oh, it's not about God. It's not, you're welcome to sit here, because again, they're losing attendance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is true. You don't, there is nothing about God, right? God to me is just good orderly direction, right? Mm-hmm. That's, I heard that once and I'm like, I like that, mm-hmm. right? But again, too, seeing business meetings and having the proposal of taking God out of the literature, you have never seen anarchy till you go to an AA meeting mm-hmm. and tell them about taking God out of the thing. Because mm-hmm. like, it is.
They're very rigid.
Yeah. And so again, it's supposed to be that thing. But like, yeah, man, I went to every AA meeting. I went to Sex Anonymous things. I went to Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters. I went to every AA meeting you could think of on that list just mm-hmm. to like see what was up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the common thing that I always didn't like was this, you know, they tell us that pride is the devil, pride and ego is the dying thing of all addicts, but they have so much pride on their clean time.
Yeah.
So much.
Yeah.
And the chips and the da da da, and there's just, that is what the whole focus is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you tell me that pride is the devil, but yet I can't do anything until I have that time and I'm supposed to be proud. And hi, my name's Griffin Smith and I'm an addict and I've been sober for 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, or hi, my name's Bill. I'm a grateful recovering addict of 38 years. Well, what have you been doing, Bill? Right?
Like, I know that's your qualm. Like, at what point are you recovered?
Right. And it says in the literature when you can be recovered.
Yeah.
Right. And that it's something that, I struggled with quite a bit. And I've seen too many addicts fall because of that shame.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, I laugh, because there's such shame with it, because they put so much pride into that time. And yes, it's nice to get a chip. And yes, it's a nice reminder of the work you're doing. But it contrasts a lot of things too, right? It's my thinking is just, what are you doing today? Right? Like, that is, I don't care whether you've been sober for 30 years, 3 days or three, what are you doing today? Right? And that's, I mean, they say that in their slogans and whatever, but
then,
it's quite a flip. And again, too, I mean, there's just, it's just finding, just find a good meeting, just go shopping. and eventually you find good people, and they're just, and it's free.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong with that when you got nothing.
Do you think that, because I want to get into obviously your journey of sobriety prior to taking ADHD meds, but I think part of the kind of core part of the 12 step is not using any sort of mind altering substance, which can make taking ADHD medication a no-no or a bit taboo if you are actively in the community. Was that your experience? Or,
well, being out of AA for a while since, well, COVID pretty much, because I didn't like the Zoom meetings and I stemmed away from it, including the friends.
So you've kind of been out of the program for about 5 years.
Yeah, about that. I've come back and forth, but there's too much anxiety going to a group that I used to be at. I mean, you know, it's a very selfish move in my mind to like come back and forth. But again, to the actual community part of it is, yeah, it's abstinence free, right? And there's so much, because again, too, a lot of the people in there, they have prescriptions for antidepressants, and right, that is all,
or sleep medication, or
and again, too, it's not that you're not welcome, it's just that they put so much shame on that. Well, then you're not actually clean. Right?
I know. You're talking about the stigma around ADHD medication, which we're like slowly trying to chip away at changing people's viewpoint on it, because it is a stimulant. Well, for the most part, ADHD meds are stimulants. And so that directly conflicts with the idea of sobriety. Well, you're taking a mind-altering substance.
Yeah. It's, I think... truthfully, it's just because of the name that it has, that phetamine part of it, and that people, and I joked with you too, calling it diet meth, right?
Yeah, like, you called it diet meth.
Yeah, that's what we called it, right? And that was, but again, it was a lot of just ignorance for the most part, and just how was raised and rather beliefs. But yeah, because we can understand that demon that gets awoken by the addict, and I've seen it too. I've seen people slip up with a muscle relaxant, and all of a sudden they're putting fentanyl in their arm with a needle, and that's true. People that have a little bit of NyQuil cough syrup, and all of a sudden they're drinking a 2-6 of vodka that next day, because they've awoken that little thing. They have one scratch ticket, and all of a sudden they're betting the rent money, right? It's the same idea. So I can't understand it, but it's quite the struggle. But if we start trusting people that are maybe smarter than us with degrees, and like, this is not,
do you think you would have been ready to take ADHD meds like early in your recovery?
No, seeing friends and hearing their stories, and this is multiple peoples that have, what they say, relapsed on ADHD meds, and that, again, like I said, drugs and alcohol are my solution, right? So they're always going to be my problem. It's not my thinking. It's not anything else going on. But I see this commonality of like, that we always will blame the substance. What is your drug of choice? What is your thing, right? Well, it was that. The cough syrup got me, or the ADHD meds got me. We never talk about, so I see this, what else was going on in your life? Because I know what was going on in your life, right? And that is,
like, maybe it wasn't the ADHD medication. Maybe it was the other stressors.
But I have this little thing that makes me feel a little bit different, and I'm the addict, and I want to feel different. I want to feel things, right? So as long as now I can take this, right? And that is that's the insanity about the diseases. I can turn anything into everything, right?
Because I think even I've tried to sort of reframe that with you before, when you've said, you know, friends have said they've relapsed using ADHD medication, as the gateway, we'll call it. And I've said, okay, well, if they were taking ADHD meds for, let's say a year, 365 days, and they relapsed one day of taking those meds, was it really the medication? Because it didn't happen day one, day two, day three, day four, et cetera.
Exactly.
So, and I would also argue, would they have relapsed more times without ever treating their ADHD?
Yeah.
Like, and can that actually bring someone enough stability that they can stay sober longer or for longer durations?
Yeah, there's the stigma of, like, well, like I said, like, early recovery is a lot of those. So, I mean, you come fresh off, you know, you got nothing, right? Mm-hmm. You're mentally, spiritually, and physically unwell. Mm-hmm. Very, right? Yeah. And now we need to attack all three prongs, right? So what's the first thing? Go to the doctor, mm-hmm. right? See what's up, because usually I got some other bumps and bruises too, right? So again, too, that prescription of need it be any harm reduction, we'll put harm reduction tools in with ADHD meds too, right? Is that right away that you're given that, but my dopamine receptors, my everything, I'm physically unwell at that point, right? I have abused those things, right? So the model of AA is correct, where I really need to, I got to raw dog this, right?
Which is, I think that's valid.
Yeah. That first year recovery, you're not going to date anybody, right? So let's not do anything in that first year so I can actually, you know, reset that platform and find some better things. So I was trying to tell my friends of, like, when I helped finally make that decision to go get that diagnosis and get those meds, I'm 8 years in.
Right.
I would hope that stinking thinking, as they call it, has gone away.
Right.
Yes, the insanity.
You were ready at that point.
Yeah. I think in the first year, God, no.
Okay.
That's why they tell you not to date anybody, right? Because I am not well.
Yeah. It took you like 5 years to even get a cat.
So the plant, cat, then human, right? is supposed to be the model, right?
Yeah.
So it's a final, I don't know. I struggle with that one in my head of, like, yes, again, you should have those. But again, too, I think
everyone's different.
Yeah.
And you got to really tune into yourself and go, can I do this? Depending on how long I've been in addiction, how severe it is. Do I need to reset for longer than that before I can really trust myself that I can use this prescription and I can use it in the correct way?
Yeah. And then having those, and again, it's the people around you, having those open, honest conversations, because again, too, it's that I need to have that to openly express those things, because my disease wants me alone and dead, right?
Yeah.
So as long as if it can do that, but too many of us blame it. Mm. It's not it, it's you. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, it's a world of difference. But no, I would suggest, after the first year.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, harm reduction tools, you need those obviously right away for some of us. But the other stuff, no, I think it needs to be later on.
Yeah.
Depending on the severity of your disease too. There's too many, again, like, I gravitated towards stimulants. Surprise.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, it's a different feeling, right? So it's,
I always ask clients that if they ever come to me and say, you know, I am struggling or I've struggled with any sort of stimulant. For the most part, it's cocaine. And I always ask them, well, tell me a bit about what's happening when you're using it. What are you using it for?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what's leading up. What's going on? Oh, you're using it to go to work, to go to study.
Yeah.
To just function day to day. You're not using it even to party. And I mean, of course, that can coincide with partying, but you're just using it to, like, get through.
Yeah. So, like, that
you'd be surprised what ADHD meds can do for you.
Yeah.
You
don't need that. And knowing our medical and technological advances since those 12 steps were written in 1939,
I would say too. I mean, we know so much more about the impact of trauma. I wish there was way more, you know, trauma psychoeducation and informed perspectives used in recovery, but we don't need to get into that.
No, but again, that's why the attendance has gone down and people are going towards the smart meetings because there might be more, but I suggest using all tools. But again, too, there's a lot more positive things that have come up since then, right?
Yeah.
So that model doesn't work for all. Again, too, people being California sober. I've seen some severe heroin addicts just smoke weed. That's cool, Bill. Mm-hmm. And that works for them, right?
Harm reduction.
And that is, right? It's not up to me to decide what you do.
Yeah, we know one of those guys.
Yeah, we do.
It's true. So, were you scared to start ADHD meds after being sober for 8 years?
No.
Close to 8 years?
No, I wasn't. You mean, doing like self-medicating with a couple university students I worked with and that kind of stuff too. And I'd already taken like some before getting an actual prescription and like, mm-hmm. oh, wow, like this is... What do you mm-hmm. mean I can breathe at 3 o'clock in the afternoon? Mm-hmm. What are you talking mm-hmm. about? Like that, right? Huh. Right. Mm-hmm. That's not
the calm.
That's
the
not.
Quiet.
Yeah, that's not what a stimulant's digital people, right? Like yeah. that is. Oh.
Yeah.
Right. But again, too, like I said earlier, the chase and the get like that. I'm telling you, is 90% of the fun.
The addiction. Whereas when someone hands it to yeah. you, that's not meeting. It's not scratching yeah. that itch.
But
you're going, well, there wasn't any like seeking in this, so I'll just.
And I know I wasn't scared because of you, and of course I'm going to trust the people that I love and care about more than myself, right?
I mean, I'd say I tried to plant that seed in your ear for a few years.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Like, I think it took a while to kind of sift through that stigma around it.
Yeah. It's just fearful. It was fear that I didn't want to go back to that place, right? I couldn't go back to that place no matter what.
Yeah.
Right. And that is good. But again, too, the, you know, phases in life and time does go on, right? Yeah. And different things happen and
you can maybe even trust yourself.
Yeah. Like I could call myself recovered from hard drugs and alcohol, but mm-hmm. I'm still insane at the end of the day, right? No matter what.
Yeah.
So that never alleviates. So no, I wasn't scared at all. It was, just because I was around people that I love and care about and
you had that stability in your life in order to feel like you could do it.
Yeah, 100%. So there was no...
Did you notice any positive changes? Like, either right off the bat when you took them, or like, you've been on them now for, what did we say, 4 months?
February, March, April, May, 4 months, yeah.
Yeah.
4 months, so...
Any benefits that you've seen, or...
I think it was just...
drawbacks?
Just, like, instantly, the first week that, like, all the coworkers, they were like, who is this guy? Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I remember even the first week of like the two gals I work with and just like sitting down, we had like a one-on-two meeting with them, but they were like, I was like actually listening to their problems and their quotes, like, and we came like, and they were like, instantly they were like, who is it? Like, and that was another story, and they're like, who is this guy? Yeah. Right. And just like a sense of like calm.
Yeah.
And that was, I didn't tell anybody. Right. Mm-hmm. And they were just like, is he high? Like that's how I knew
it was doing something when you get that feedback from other people.
Yeah. And they're like, what are you on? I'm like, oh yeah. I got that. So finally.
Yeah.
Right. So that in a sense is that, yeah, that's
what brought you to that point when you were finally ready, like when you were finally ready to go, you know what, I'm going to give this a shot. Cause I mean, I've in the background had been telling you for years, I've got ADHD. I know you've got ADHD.
And I think just living, you know, kept doing the same thing. Oh, it was just the burnouts.
Okay.
Like I finally, like to me always questioning of like, am I bipolar? Is this like dissociative depression? And always questioning the dark side.
You were questioning the ups and the downs.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So always, and just having that, dealing with that for, you know, the last, you know, umpteen years. And like, that is the dark side of it that nobody talks about. That's what I was sick of.
Okay.
Right. And that needed to change.
I think that's an important thing to talk about too, because there can feel like ups and downs, and we're not talking about like manic episodes followed by depressive episodes. We're talking about like, I'm interested in something, or I've got all of this energy and then I end up taking on too much and then I burn myself out, or I'm just like burning the candle at both ends and I can't seem to keep up. I can't seem to manage day to day life. And I'm just like constantly running on this treadmill, and then I get tired and I, you know, shut down.
Yeah. And that's what I was just sick of. Right. And that And again, too, I tried everything else but this.
Yeah.
So why not? Yeah. What are you fearful of? Mm-hmm. Right. And again, too, it's childhood, parental figures telling me that, you know, you don't take a pill, you don't take this, mm-hmm. you don't need help. Mm-hmm. You don't take help from anything. And then you'll mm-hmm. just be, if you get one pill, you get another pill, and you get another one, and you get another one. So that, I mean, people telling you that as a kid, then you instantly know of like, well, no, I'm not asking for help.
Right.
Right. Like, okay, if I get pneumonia, I'll take an antidote, right? That, okay.
Again,
right?
If it's like all the way extreme.
Yeah. And that was the big thing with it. Right. And that was, you know, even an active addiction of like seeing dealers. And yeah, I mean, you had your Adderalls on the street and that kind of stuff. And it was always, you know, well, I got these ones, and you're like, I don't want that. Like that was always the joke of it too. Right. And it was, so that, I mean, it manifests over years, mm-hmm. and it just, you know.
So as someone that struggled with such, I would say like an intense addiction, do you feel like since you've been on ADHD meds, has any of that come back up? Like, have you worried about your sobriety, or has that felt like it was like a gateway drug?
No, because it's, again, too, my thinking is drastically different.
Okay.
Right? So I can make that conscious decision. I know I can make it through the day without drugs and alcohol.
Right.
I know that. I can make that logical choice. Mm-hmm. Yes, I understand the insanity and feelings of everyone else.
You've proven that to yourself.
Then. Right. So I've learned to love and trust myself, right? And at the end of the day, I think it's actually opposite. I'm consuming less caffeine, less nicotine, less mm-hmm. sweet food at night, mm-hmm. losing weight. So my body's not always looking for that dopamine hit, you know, wherever it is at reach, yep. right? And, you know, that's the choice of it. So in a sort of instinctual way, that my body, like, I'm not not looking. So my logical side of it and the physical side of it isn't looking for that, yeah. right? So that's where I think that later treatment. Getting those meds is, I think is.
I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Like, that can give you that stability where all of a sudden your brain's not seeking in whatever it might be. I'm looking, you know, to upregulate or downregulate my nervous system with caffeine, with nicotine, mm-hmm. with shopping, with mm-hmm. gambling, with yeah. food, with all of the other things yeah. that might not be drugs and alcohol,
yeah.
but it is something else, yeah, whatever else that might be.
So I think, yeah, it did like on a, I think the opposite. I mean, it's early, but like, yeah, it's no, it's not the thought, because my thinking is, I don't know anybody where I live. My whole lifestyle is gone. I don't, yes, I can walk into a bar and get a pint. Like that's,
yeah.
But the logical side of me knows, no, you don't do that today.
Yeah.
So no, I think it's, but you know, life is going to happen. So again, too, going with different changes in my life, some like bigger changes recently, and seeing where those meds are, like, it does make you those feelings like really kind of come about, where I can more obsess about it. I can focus more on it. Whereas before, my brain was just programmed not to feel anything, not besides the toxic masculinity part about it. But like, so it's interesting to see,
I think I know what you're kind of referring to, in the sense of you actually kind of notice feelings more than you did before.
Yeah. So that I'm more nervous about too, but like, because again, I'm an addict, I want to feel different. Right. So it's healthier, because again, too, that if there's anything to regret, it's like, man, you haven't felt anything for a long time, even in recovery. Right. Because I don't want to feel anything bad. Right. And that is, I think that's going to be the struggle more than anything too. It'll be interesting for myself, but
maybe the next step is getting a therapist. Maybe.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's attacking everything on all corners, right? Yeah. You need to, one can fix the other, right? It's that you need that circle of good people to fight the circle of evil.
Yeah. So if someone was listening to this episode and was sober, struggling with their ADHD, what would you say to them?
Well, I would ask if they have been diagnosed earlier, if they just think they're self-diagnosing, or what their mental health diagnosis is currently. I'd want to know, like, that, so to say. just saying that there are more resources than you think. There are non-stimulant options, as you've educated mm-hmm. me about too. And because again, you were trying to plant one seed, and you're like, well, I might as well try the other one.
Yeah, so that's a good one. If you are, you know, averse to trying stimulant, you mm-hmm. can try non-stimulant.
Yeah, options. And that's again too. It's not. I can't judge other people's stories, right? Yeah. So again, too, those individuals that I know that have relapsed on that, and my personal thoughts is like I kind of roll my eyes mm-hmm. at it too, right? But that's your mm-hmm. story. That's your thing. I don't care. So I mean, it's just finding out those mm-hmm. other options.
I would add to that too. You can also seek ADHD coaching. Or find an ADHD-informed therapist. Mm-hmm. So if you, for whatever reason, can't take medication and or aren't ready, don't want to, that doesn't have to be the only way to treat ADHD. You can yeah. absolutely lean into psychosocial supports. Mm-hmm. What can I do to learn to manage this differently so that I can function better?
Yeah, again too, it's the fear of the addict reaching out for help, and that's so that I struggled with it. I still struggle with it to yeah. this day. So just know that there are more options out there, especially nowadays, and hopefully there'll be more in the future as yeah. well, right? And it's yeah, we're getting to go hang out with some neurodivergent people.
Yeah, I mean,
see what happens.
I mean, do you think that there was probably a lot of ADHDers in those 12-step rooms?
Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I have walked into any of those meetings, I'm like, this place is riddled with yeah. ADHD. Just riddled with it.
Just go to Cocaine Anonymous meeting. It's amazing. Oh, nothing gets done.
Truly.
Fantastic ideas.
Truly. Truly. You're yeah. like, oh, okay. I understand everybody here.
Yeah. And it's accepting it, finding good people. And yeah, find like that's just, you got to put yourself out there.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, we live in 2025. There's, you know, just finding a good group of somebody to talk to even, mm-hmm. right? And just eventually.
Gotta find your people.
Yeah. And you get to that point and things can change, and it's, yeah, there's other options for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I would say to that.
Okay. That was good. What is something that you are proud of in this journey, whether that's your journey through addiction, your journey into ADHD, what's one thing that you can say you're proud of?
Step one is honesty.
Mm.
Right? It's being honest with yourself and not being honest, but the acceptance, right? I was honest that I was, you know, I was an addict even when in, but the acceptance of it, right? It's that, you know, I tell everybody, I don't care. I truly don't care about, I mean, it may be oversharing, so I might be stemming a little bit of that, but like, I have no shame in it. There's zero shame with
me. You've gotten rid of the shame.
Oh, like almost instantly too, right? Like even, you know, in the dating world and that kind of stuff. And I just put it out there, right? And you get the ones that like walk away, but then like, usually the common ground is like, oh yeah, I have an uncle that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's that I think is what I'm most proud of. It's just, it's accepting of it, right? That I don't have any shame of it. I joke, right? Even going to all-inclusive places, like, you know, I just tell people, right? And it's, you know, you spark up that conversation, just don't, no shame and guilt in it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one thing I'd be most proud of.
Okay.
Right. And I think in truly having
that. You should be proud of that.
Yeah. And having that acceptance of it then also helps me not do it, right? Yeah. Because that, again, step one.
Yeah.
I admit that I'm powerless, right? Yeah. So it's not just admitting it, but it's accepting it.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
If you could, looking back on your younger self, this could be child self who had untreated, unmedicated, unknown ADHD, what advice would you give him?
Listen to your sister.
Yes. Always listen to your sister.
Can you repeat the question?
If you could go back and look at your child self, what would you say to him? Like, in who you are now and knowing everything you know and what you've been through, what advice would you give him?
I don't think I would give any advice because I love my life now.
Mm.
So I don't think it would turn out any different.
Mm.
So I wouldn't give any advice.
Okay.
I would tell my younger self where I put my bicycle, but you know, that's about jokingly. But no, I wouldn't. No, I wouldn't.
And to expand on that, Griffin as a child once lost his bicycle for an entire school year because he couldn't see it behind all of the other kids' bicycles every day. Mm-hmm. And so once the school year finished and everyone moved his bike, he could finally go, oh, there's my bike.
First day of school, rode it there. Last day of school, rode it back. Yeah.
Because he couldn't see it.
Yeah, that wasn't a sign. I don't know what it was.
Yeah. I think it was for me, like when I think about you as a kid, it was your backpack was always left open.
Yeah.
You're always dropping things, always constantly losing things.
Yeah, because I wasn't that hyperactive kid. I wasn't the one that was fighting the walls. I wasn't.
No, I wasn't. It was, like, you were the inattentive.
Yeah, and I mean, I was a 90s kid. Every boy was on Ritalin except me, right? But because I wasn't that super aggressive boy, right? So it got thrown under the radar, so to say, because that's how all the boys in the 90s, rather, I should preface. No girls got diagnosed.
That's the stereotypical presentation, which is why you're right. A lot of girls didn't get diagnosed and or boys that didn't fit into those criteria.
Yeah. So again, as a kid, I never really, so going into adulthood, I never really thought, acceptance of it is that I never accepted that I had it because, like, I'm not like little Billy. I'm not punching holes in the drywall, right? Like, what are you? That's not me, right? Yeah. Like, but again, too, and again, I didn't even know ADD and ADHD were the same things that you told me like 2 weeks ago. It's like, oh, shit, really? I thought it was different. Like, no, that name has changed, right? So I'm like, oh, okay. I thought it was different.
Yeah.
Right? So again, but I was never a hyper kid, right? Yeah. So, but it's that was a clear sign. But no, I wouldn't tell myself, my younger self, anything. No. And again, too, that goes with the regrets of, like, people, you know, why wasn't I wanting this before? And it's like, yeah, but it wouldn't have turned out how it is now if it wasn't for that.
Okay.
So no, I wouldn't.
Okay.
Just tell them it'll be all right and listen to your sister.
Okay. Great. That's great closing remarks. Is there anything else that you want to say that I haven't touched on? Any other kind of parting words?
No.
Okay.
We'll just leave it as normal. It's just a setting on the dryer.
Okay. I love that. I actually do love that. I feel like I might write that. I have a whiteboard in my office, and I might actually write, normal is just a setting on the dryer.
It's better than the Kanye tweet.
We're not doing that. Anyways, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you being vulnerable, being willing to have this conversation, and potentially helping someone that's listening, changing someone's life. Mm-hmm. And I really thank you for shedding light on the conversation of addiction, because again, it's not as often talked about. And I think it's important to be able to be honest about it. And
that's any mental health. Just have the conversation.
Just have the conversation.
Yeah.
Okay. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to ADHD Brief. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing or sharing it with someone who might relate. For more information on resources from today's episode, check out the show notes on your listening platform or feel free to contact us directly. The views and opinions shared by my guests are their own and may not always reflect mine. At ADHD Brief, we value open conversations and differing perspectives. I encourage listeners to approach each episode with kindness and curiosity. Even when something comes from a place of stigma or misunderstanding, offering grace and compassion creates more room for growth than criticism ever could. Thanks for tuning in.